people go on a diet, you see, so they live by certain rules. The rules fail, they get very depressed because they didn't live by the conscience. The conscience is telling you, you must live by these rules, you see. But the thing is, if you just, you know, just eat regular, I mean, I understand a person that has problems, that's a very hard thing to do. But the thing is that it's not emotionally, I'm not saying whether you, how you should diet. I'm not talking about diet. I'm just showing the breakdown of the diet when it's based on rules of the conscience, then when you break down, do you feel 10 times worse than based on the reality? The consequences, I mean, the consequences, you have to evaluate the consequences, whether you should do it, whether you could do it. That's a separate thing, how to live in reality. And that you could learn as you think about it and as you study Proverbs and other areas of Torah, you start to value, you learn to evaluate these things. But however, all I'm trying to show with all these things is that failure, when you, by conscience, is 10 times more painful than failure insofar as a realistic type of failure. Okay? And therefore the pain is not as great. And one more time with the conscience. When it is the conscience that's not, that, in other words, you, let's say you have a goal, you have to do something, you have to diet. Okay? Now, if you set it up according to a conscience, like you have this set of rules, you see? So then, when you fail, then it's all over, and it's very depressing because you failed. The conscience condemns you for being a failure, you see? That part of you, the conscience part of you that your value system is built around, condemns you for not living according to this value system. Let's say I'd go on a diet where I would be careful every time I'd eat, I'd watch how I feel. And when I feel, I've learned to evaluate when it's hunger and when the desire is still there, and I'm doing it only for desire, not for hunger, and I only eat to remove hunger. Now, I might fail, but I know, okay, each time is a separate evaluation. Every time I sit down to eat becomes a separate evaluation. It's not a conscience. It's evaluating it realistically based on the feelings, the physical feelings that I feel right now, and to evaluate that, you're trying to evaluate it realistically to the best of your ability to distinguish between hunger and desire. And that the mind is working on each individual case. It's not a system thrown at you by the conscience, you see? So therefore, in that situation, when you fail, it is not as bad. You didn't set up a whole system that breaks down. You just looking at each individual meal separately and dealing with that meal at the time. Okay? Now, I also want to add that the book of Mishlei, that's the whole purpose of the book of Mishlei, is to change your value system from the way you were raised, the conscience value system, and to set in a realistic value system by constantly looking for the consequences of your actions. And the question is, can you raise a person without the conscience? That's impossible. Everybody, even if you're raised in the house of the greatest righteous person, you relate to him through your conscience, and then you must pull out of that value system. Then you must look at the same facts from a totally different angle. One is, so you start off as looking at it from your conscience value system, and then you must change it to a realistic value system, even though you don't have to change your lifestyle because you were raised that way. But you must change that. The difficulty of a Baal Tshuva, a person that did not live the life of Torah, then suddenly changes, is that difficulty is they have to change the whole lifestyle. It's every step has to be changed. If you're raised in the righteous house, you must change your value, the same actions, but what value you attach to them. First it's the conscience, then it's a realistic value system. But however, if your emotions are running in a different direction away from Torah, in a different lifestyle, that is much more difficult to change. I mean, then you have to change the whole personality and everything has to change. But in that way, that's much more difficult to do. Now, the thing is that the, you know, there are certain pleasures that are realistic, certain pleasures that are not. For instance, eating, enjoying taste is a physical enjoyment that's a real enjoyment. And, or the enjoyment of thought. And the enjoyment of jumping into a cold pool on a hot day, or into a hot bath on a cold day. So that's all physical. But then there's the fantasy pleasures, the emotional pleasures. And you'll find that if you win a game, that pleasure is much greater than eating an apple, or even eating a piece of cake. You know what I mean? Like, it's not the same pleasure. The fantasy pleasure is always much greater than the physical pleasure. Okay? And if you go to the world of reality, you will give up those highs that you get. But you'll also give up the lows. You have to evaluate. Because any high that you go, how high you go in the emotional pleasures, that's how low you could go. Okay? So the thing is, you remove the highs and the lows, and you live more or less an evenly keeled life. But there are enjoyments, and there's avoidance of pain, and you live a more evenly keeled life. So you give up, you have to give up the highs, but you will definitely, as you give up the highs, you will also give up the lows. So therefore, the highs are not as high and the lows are not as low. But you will have a life without that, without those conflicts that cause you to go up and down. It's based on a lot of conflicts, and unhappiness that it leads to will be removed. Okay? So therefore, again, like in anything, there has to be an evaluation. You must see the two different lifestyles of the up and down and the running and the depressions and the bad moods and the constant battling with the emotions and battling other people because you want to get ahead, that you're driven. You have to, and all the highs that you get with success and all the lows that you get with failure, you have to evaluate that in relationship to an evenly keeled life to decide which one. Even that should be made in a rational way by evaluating the lifestyle of one, the lifestyle of the other. When that becomes real to you, then you could make a commitment to the lifestyle of the realistic, because you see that's the much better lifestyle. Plus, definitely there aren't the consequences. Mishlei will point out the terrible consequences of making decisions based on the emotions, so it'll also help you in that decision making, which lifestyle you want to go, which road you want to go down. Hey, somebody, the question is that maybe somebody might say, well, it's worth it for me to have the highs over the lows. You know what I mean? Even though I have lows, it's still worth it for me to have the highs, and I'd rather live this lifestyle. When you say that, you're probably not in the throes of a depression, or in the throes of a conflict. I'd like to see somebody in that situation say, well, it's still worth it. I'm really depressed. I hate myself. And I don't see any value in myself, but it's still worth it because I know I'll get out and I'll have a high. The guy is such a thinker, I think he'll basically be able to get out of it, out of the whole thing. But also, if you're evaluating lifestyles, you must also take into consideration the consequences of living an emotional lifestyle to get those highs, what the consequences are. I'm just pointing out, in other words, see, if you learn Mishlei, you look at the lifestyle from 10, 15, 20 different ways, every different angle. I'm just pointing out one angle, and that is the answer to the person that said, how do you get out of these conflicts? I mean, the question happened to have been about depression, but it's any conflict. How do you get out of the conflict? And I'm saying there's one general way. I'm not saying you can't go further. There's further development than this. But the first step is to change your lifestyle. And I think that would have a big effect on most people. Okay? And the question that you mentioned, that if you could imagine people saying it's worth it for the high, that they say just before they're going to a party. But not be, you understand, it's because they're able to close off parts of their life, and they don't see the connection between the two. Now, it's like two different things. Like, there's a part of me that enjoys life. There's another part of me that has conflict, but they don't realize that this comes from the same source. You see, and they don't connect it, and you must undo the whole value system, the whole way of looking at life to undo it. You see? They separate between two different parts, and there's no connection between the two. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, the question is, if you have a physical pleasure, do you have an emotion attached to it? The answer is yes. I mean, you sit down and you enjoy a piece of cake, or you enjoy fruit, whatever you enjoy eating, let's say. There is an enjoyment, but it's not the enjoyment of the fantasy that I have something you don't have. I have this cake and you don't have it, ha ha ha. You see, that's a different enjoyment than the enjoyment of eating the cake, than just the taste of the food. You see, most people don't stop to enjoy the taste. Most people are on the contrary, that's why everybody's always looking for a new candy that comes out, a new cereal. What's the matter with all the old ones? But however, the fantasy, this is something new. You understand, like, wow, you can't imagine what it's going to be like. You see, that fantasy that the next pleasure down the road is going to be the unbelievable pleasure. That's going to be the best. There's always the next pleasure. But once you have it, then you just see, yeah, okay, you enjoyed it, but then you can't imagine it anymore because you experienced it. So you have to start imagining the next pleasure. Or you go into a depression, right? If you can't imagine the next pleasure, you go into a depression, right?
Rabbi,
the same thing is with smoking. Smoking is a certain physical pleasure. If you only look at the physical pleasure, it's a pleasure, but if you evaluate that pleasure versus the consequences, you know what I mean, you're definitely going to cut it out, or at least cut down to one or two a week. You understand? But however, when people smoke, I don't believe it's the smoking. I mean, there might be rebellion, especially in our society where we come out against it, a certain sense of rebellion against society. See, I smoke, and people say I don't care, you know what I mean, and then it's joining the society. Your group smokes, and if you don't smoke, they look at you funny. You understand, it's these emotions that get you, that really pull you over. But if you just look at it realistically, and a person enjoys a cigarette, so once a week or twice a week he'll take a cigarette or two, and that's it. Goodbye. I mean, you know what I mean, it's an enjoyment. You know what I mean? Like there's some people that enjoy a cup of coffee. There's some people that drink 5-6 cups. They're addicted to it. There's a difference between addiction and enjoyment. See, addiction is based on a fantasy, that you're attaching something to it beyond reality. You see? But however, an enjoyment means I enjoy it, but my mind tells me when to stop, and I can't stop, so I stop the enjoyment. It's not that there's no enjoyment. There is a enjoyment in the physical pleasures, but the nature of the enjoyment is different than the fantasy. The fantasy is always greater. Whenever that's why I said, like, when you have an argument, when the spouse sits quietly, then it's much worse, because then it's your imagination that's interpreting. You're not getting any feedback from the spouse, so you can't put it into realistic terms. So you look at it in the terms of the fantasy. That is much greater. The fantasy is much greater than reality. But the lows are also much greater, and the consequences are also terrible. So Ruth mentioned about a baby, okay? Now, the thing is, you can enjoy the child, or you start thinking about what this child is going to be when he or she grows up. So you're relating to the child insofar as your fantasies are concerned, you see? And most of the times it doesn't work out, and then your fantasies drop a little bit. That's when you get the lows. But but anyway, but the thing is that also could be, you know, really having a child is a responsibility and justice. I mean, this child is dependent on me, so I am obligated to take care of the child. Nobody else is going to take care of the child equal to me. And so, therefore, it's a responsibility to raise the child. But most people raise the child, and you want to raise the child to have the best possible life for them. Now, most people don't raise a child. That's very hard to raise a child that way. I mean, most of the time, it's this child is me. It's an extension of me. And this child is going to be like me. And if they're not like me, I'll kill them, you know. But that's the fantasy, you see. There's a difference between the fantasy view of life and everything in life and the realistic view of life. It is very, very different. Now, if you listen to all the examples, you'll see that it's really two different lifestyles. It's not in a particular act that I change. It's changing my total value system of how I look at life. And that is really the purpose of the Book of Mishlei. That is the introduction of all of Torah philosophy, is the Mishlei's Proverbs. That is the introduction. The basic is to change your value system from a conscience, the way you were raised and the society you were raised in, the friends that you hang with, that they become your conscience, and you change that to a realistic value system. The question is, it's so hard to change. The answer is that how you change, how you make the change, is you must see the value for changing by going over these ideas realistically to see the value. And then don't force yourself to change, but enjoy the process, because it's a long process, and the process is sitting down to learn. Some people will open the Book of Mishlei, and they'll work on Mishlei. Certain people will listen to tapes. You know what I mean? There's different approaches. There's not one approach. I mean, each according to their abilities could do it, especially today. They have plenty of tapes out from different areas, you know, that could help you. So the thing is that it's a slow process. But the thing is, enjoy in every single idea, and slowly but surely, as the every time the mind sees the idea clear. In other words, every time you hear an idea, don't trust the person, but question them until it's clear to the mind. Once it's clear to the mind, that's it. Then it affected you. Then go to the next idea. It doesn't even matter if you don't remember it. Remembering is only for future use. But insofar as affecting you, just to know the idea. It's not a matter of remembering the idea. It's to be changing your personality until you naturally think a certain way. You can't use these principles and say, well, what principle should I do now? You can't do that. It's a change of your whole nature, and that change comes about by reviewing and going over till you see each idea. One idea clear is much more valuable than 100 ideas that are not clear. That will affect you 10 times more. I don't think that an experience, some people say like an experience like in Israel, that the fear of death every day, so they live life as if, you know, it's the last day. But the fact is that they're still living by their conscience. to change from how they make decisions and how they live their life is their conscience. There has to be a training in mind that changes the way you think. An experience can change you, but the experience will not change you in the way we're talking about. The experience will change you according to your personality. It will have to fit into your personality. But changing your personality only comes through chachma and wisdom and study and ideas. It doesn't come from an experience. In other words, how you relate to an experience is based on who you are. And if you have a conscience-type value system, and what your conscience is, that's the way you relate to the situation. If you're trained with thought, then you will relate to the situation differently. Now, a situation could cause you, let's say, for instance, situation might cause me to sit and learn, but I haven't changed my personality yet until I've spent a certain amount of years involvement in learning. A situation might suddenly awaken me to go in the correct direction, but the experience will not change my personality. Any changes must be within the personality that there was. Only learning, only knowledge is the only way out of these type of conflicts, and that's by changing your total value system. The question is, how does psychiatrists work? That's a further development. I think that, in other words, certain people it's not for everybody. You have to know, I think most people could make a change through the learning, through this learning process which we just spoke about, seeing the consequences of your actions, a realistic value system. But however, certain people can't get to that thing because their emotions don't allow them, so they might need professional help to help them get over that thing that's stopping them, that's resisting them learning. Once they pass that, then they could change the value system. And you could do it in one lump sum. You don't take individual problems, you take total personality, change it over. And I'm not saying this is the end step, I'm saying this is the first step. Mishlei is the beginning of all of Torah, the introduction. It's not the final step, but it's a big step. It's a big step. I'm not talking about a person that has to rely on medication. That's something else. I'm not saying that isn't a good thing. I'm just saying for the regular person that has ups and downs, has different conflicts. And when I said depression, I'm only giving one. And I'm not saying this could undo all the conflicts. I'm just saying it must start here. And it must start with changing your value system. Okay? Now, I'm not saying what psychiatrists do is bad. I mean, there are a lot of them. They're good psychiatrists. They're good. You just got to be careful of phonies there, or people that think they know when they don't know. That's a separate problem. But the fact is, the first step should be the changing of your value system. Okay, we're back in Shoftim, chapter. That's Judges, chapter of a six. Verse 9 and 10, and he says, he's speaking to Gideon, the prophet or an angel or a prophecy came to Gideon, and he's speaking to Gideon and through God, and God is saying that I saved you from the hands of the Egyptians and from all the oppressors, and I drove them from you, and I've given to them your land, and I said to you, I am God your God. Don't be frightened of the gods of the Amori, that you dwell in their land, and you didn't listen to my voice. Okay? In other words, they took on the gods of the Amori. Those were people that lived in Israel at the time. Then later, God tells them, he says, take the ox that belongs to your father. Okay, that was an ox set aside for the Baal. Baal was a certain type of idol. And there was another idol, there was another ox set aside for 7 years, also for the idol. He says, and you should break down the altar of the Baal that is to your father, And the Asherah, Asherah was a tree that they worshipped that's right by it, you should cut down. And then you should build an altar to God, and you should make it level, right? And you should take the second ox, and you should bring it up as a sacrifice, and use the wood of the Asherah that you ripped down. Okay? Now, the thing is that according to law, this would be not permitted. Okay? We're not allowed to use for a sacrifice the animals that were set up for idolatry. And we don't sacrifice at night, and this is outside of the Beis HaMikdash. So, and it's at night. There were a lot of mistakes here. The only thing is that there's a certain time that God says that the laws of the Torah are suspended for a certain period. This comes through God at certain situations. So therefore, if this happened now, these things must have a meaning, that why he used the sacrifices of the Baal for a sacrifice to God, and the wood of the Asherah was used to burn that sacrifice. Okay? And the question is, why? Why did God do this? Why was this so important that many laws are being violated this way, and yet God told them this is what he wants them to do? There is a law that a person that's a gambler, a professional gambler, cannot be a witness in Jewish law. But if he repents, so then he can become a witness. How does he repent? If he destroys all the tools of his trade, like break the dice, rip up all his cards, everything that he has for the tools of his trades, he breaks down. In other words, you're very attached to this because it's your profession, and you make money that way. Well, for instance, somebody steals and they use certain traps to catch birds, other people's birds. You're allowed to use traps to catch wild birds. But there were other people's birds, there was ways of knowing. You would set traps for them. So you want to repent. Part of the repentance was breaking your traps. You see? And therefore, you must know the cause. You must undo the cause of your sin. In other words, the cause of us being subservient to the enemy, that for 7 years we were under their the enemy, they controlled us, they would come in and torment us. So the thing is that you have to know the cause. Some people would say, oh, the cause is because we're weak and they're stronger. But that's not true. You have to know the cause is because you did not relate to God. You must know the cause and then destroy that which you're attached to. You see? You must destroy that. So the first thing that God commanded Gideon was to destroy the idol and the altar to the Baal and use the tree that they worshipped as firewood for the sacrifice to God of the animals that were set aside for the Baal, to the idol. So that is the recognition of the cause. In curing yourself, you must always know the cause and be able to deal with the cause. That's the idea. This was an idea given by the Rabak. Okay. And so then the question is that why do they have to do it in this way? Why don't they just destroy it? The answer is that you use it for God. You turn it for God. Like the... also see how attached they are to the Baal, that when the people found out that Gideon did it, they wanted to kill him. They wanted to kill him. And that's why he had to do the sacrifice at night, So that was the only way he could get it done, because if not, the people would have definitely stopped them. Okay, in Judges, Shoftim chapter 6 tells the story that Gideon slaughtered the cow and of the Baal, and he destroyed the altar of the Baal. Baal was a was an idol of the city where he lived in. The next day the people woke up and they saw it broken. They made an investigation, and they found that Gideon did it, and they wanted to kill him. In verse 31 of chapter 6, his father, Gideon's father, speaks, and it says like this: "And Joash said to all that were standing by him, 'Are you going to fight for Baal? Are you a savior for him?'" Him meaning the Baal. "Anybody that fights for him should die by morning. If he is a god, he should fight for himself against the person that broke his altar." Okay? And so the people backed off. Okay? Question is, what was Joash's strategy to save his son? The question is not to prove whether the Baal is a god or not. The question that we're dealing with is a strategy. Joash was only interested in saving his son. So the question is, what was the strategy in saving his son? What method of strategy or plan did he have to save his son? In other words, what you're trying to say is that he's using a logical argument to disprove them, their god. However, these are very religious people. You see how religious they are, that they were willing to kill anybody that went against their god. You can't use a logical argument. If you use a logical argument, it's not going to be acceptable. You know what I mean? I mean, these people were going to kill somebody for violating the altar of the Baal, breaking the altar of the Baal. I mean, you're talking about powerful religious emotions. I don't think a logical argument is going to work. Right. So the answer, Doug gave the answer like this: that in other words, they are religious people. Based on their feeling of religiosity, he uses their emotions to convince them that they would be doing an irreligious act to kill this man. Because if they did it, that means the Baal can't defend himself, and the Baal is weak because he needs them to do the act. So he says that would be an irreligious act, because that would be an insult to the god of Baal that you have to protect them. So what he did was he put it in their framework why they should not kill his son Gideon. In other words, you must know the emotions of the person that you're dealing with, and then put the plan into their framework, so therefore they will act upon, in their framework they will act upon it, so therefore then you'll get the results that you desire. Alright, we also find in Megillas Esther, the book of Esther, that's chapter 7, verse 4. She has Haman and Achashverosh at the party, at the second party. And verse 3 says, Queen Esther replied, saying, "If I have gained your majesty favor, and if his majesty deems it proper, let my life be granted me by my request, and my people by my wish." In verse 4 she says, "For we were sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, slaughtered, and annihilated. Now, had we been sold as slaves and maidservants, I would have remained silent. But the oppressor has no regard for losses incurred by his majesty." You see? Now, she's asking for a life. What is this that the oppressor has no regard for losses incurred by his majesty? What does that mean? What we see is another thing that she was out to save her life and to save the life of the nation. But she also knew that Ahasuerus only thinks in terms of his own benefits. So at the verse 3, she says, if you could let my life be granted me by my request. So first she puts it in her life because she knew that Ahasuerus would think that he's losing this beautiful woman that he wanted to be his wife. So first of all, he's losing there. And secondly, she shows that Haman doesn't think in terms of Ahasuerus, so why should he pay money that Ahasuerus should kill them all out? Let him be sold as slaves. Ahasuerus should have a benefit. So in those two points, she puts it in Ahasuerus's framework so that he would feel a personal loss, and therefore the hatred of Haman would be great enough to harm him. But it was only to be nice to the queen. That is not Ahasuerus is not a nice guy. He's only in it for his own benefit. So she pointed out two things. One, that she would totally lose, he would totally lose her, which he wanted, the beautiful woman. And two, he lost out because they're all being killed out and they're losing out on slaves. So you see that Esther put it in his, the plan was to put it in his framework. The question is that if you know the strategy, then you could do a lot of harm with the strategy too. Evil could also use, evil people could also use this strategy to harm others. Okay? The answer to that is that that's why we have the idea of Musar. Musar, according to Sadyagon, according to most of the commentaries that I've seen, is to evaluate the immediate pleasure or pain, the pain that you can avoid or the pleasure that you're going to get, versus future pleasure or pain that you're going to avoid. Okay? When you do that and you start seeing the harm of evil, so that controls you from using this method of strategy to harm others. If you don't, it is possible, if you have this and you don't have the control, that you don't understand why you shouldn't do evil, it's possible to know these methods and you could definitely go over the line. That's definitely a possibility. So therefore, a person, when they have these methods, they should make sure they also understand why they should not use it for evil. Okay? That's the first thing. Second question is, let's say I could use one of these methods of selling something to another person for a good reason. I'm really affecting him psychologically that he should buy a book that deals with, let's say, Torah ideas that I know will benefit him, but I use it in such a way that he should, that he would buy the book, and I use this method. And is that wrong because I'm really not talking to his mind, I'm talking to his emotions, okay, and I'm just trying to win him over? So the question is that wrong? The question is, do you have the right to manipulate somebody where it is beneficial for the other person, that it really is a benefit, and you're not trying to fool the person just for your own benefit, even though it doesn't benefit the other person? That's the question. In other words, according to the ideas that we're learning here, you see that you have the right to manipulate people. Okay? So the thing is that now the question is, do you have the right to manipulate the person to teach them Torah? To get across ideas of Torah?
Yeah, well,
in other words, if somebody cannot manipulate others, they don't have the ability to manipulate others, we would hold that's a weakness. Person should have the ability to manipulate others where it's absolutely necessary, like we see in the case of Yoash and we see in the case of Esther, that you definitely have the right to manipulate. The only thing is you have to make the decision when it's right or wrong. Now what the question is, let's say a person could learn Torah if you manipulate them. Okay? The question is that a situation that you can manipulate them? That's the question. There's a Gemara in Shabbos. I don't remember the exact page it's on. But a non-Jew came to Hillel. He happened to have heard about the beautiful clothing that a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, wore. So he came to Hillel. He first came to Shammai and he said, convert me on the condition that I should become a high priest. And Shammai chased him away. And then he came to Hillel, and Hillel said, okay. And there were other cases that way. They mentioned around 2-3 cases. And then when he sat down to learn, after a certain amount of time, he found out that he cannot become a Kohen Gadol. He can't become a high priest. He came back to Hillel, says, how come you lied to me? So Hillel says, but aren't you happy now that you know what learning is and the real benefits of Torah? Aren't you happy? So he said, yeah. So you see that Hillel holds that you could even lie and manipulate a person to learn Torah, and then he converted him. Well, Shammai held not. So that is wherein lies how far you could go with Torah, depending who you hold by. And the question is, why? Okay? You understand? That would be the two philosophies, I think. We're doing chapter 30, verse 1 through 6. It's one subject. And I'm going to explain this totally according to the Meiri. And we're going to go totally according to the Meiri. And the verse 1 says that the words of Ogur, the son of Yochef, about prophecy, the word of the Gever to Isiel, and he told it, this person told it to Isiel and Uchol, which is two different people. Okay? Rashi learns this first verse as a totally metaphorical, and all these words represent certain ideas. But the Meiri just learns it as an introduction that this Ogur was a person that said it to Isiel. Who Ogur is, some people say it's Shlomo, some people say it was the students of Shlomo, some people say it was his teachers, or Shlomo's teachers, but these were very great, outstanding person. And I guess Isiel Baruchal, the Meiri says, they was people that were known at that time. And people that were known at that time that were very famous and intellectual people. Okay? That's just basically the introduction. Verse 2. He says, because I am more animal than man. By animal he means a fool. And I do not have the understanding of man. Okay? Now, if we're talking about Shlomo or any of these people, we're talking about great thinkers. Now, you understand that maybe a certain height of level he doesn't have. But to call himself a fool, he just wrote a book, especially if it's Shlomo, he just wrote a book about not being a fool, and he's training people not to be a fool. I'm sure he wasn't a fool. He calls himself a fool, he doesn't have understanding. I mean, he wrote a book on the whole basis of how to undo this. I mean, he wasn't on that level. Sounds absolutely nuts. So the question is, what is the verse talking about? The Gemer is the author, the person that wrote it, that's Ogur, said it to Isiel, and they're discussing some aspect of prophecy. That was in the first verse, okay? There are two parts to the human being. There's thought, ideas, and functionality. How he functions in the physical world. How that thought operates in the physical world. Now, the thing is that there is a model of what is human perfection in these two areas. In other words, there has to be a certain model of what is perfection of the intellect and what is the perfection of functionality. In other words, how you function. That's the intellect. And how the emotions affect the intellect, or how the intellect affects the emotions, is how you function. in the physical world, right? Now, there is a model of that type of perfection. So when he says, I am like a animal insofar as an ish is concerned, insofar as a man is concerned, meaning in functionality, I'm not. I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm like a fool compared to the model of man that is idea or man that is functional. I am not equal to either one of the models. Now, whether any human being ever reached this model, some people want to say he used Moshe as the model, but whatever it is, whether a human being actually reached this model is not our problem. We're saying there's a certain model of perfection, and he doesn't have that model of perfection. And that's how he's starting out in this subject. Pasuk Gimel. V'lo lamadati chachma. I never learned wisdom. V'das kadoshim eda. And I don't know the holy knowledge. Okay? According to the Meiri, chachma means physical sciences. Sciences that we have. And then he says v'das kadoshim means like metaphysics. Metaphysics, ideas beyond the laws of nature. Okay? Says, I don't have that knowledge, and now we know what he means. I mean, definitely Shlomo had that knowledge, but he knows that he doesn't have it to ultimately go up to the heavens by Eirid and come down to see it clear. Come down meaning to go up and see it clearly into that thing and come down completely answered. You see? Mi'otzav ruach b'chotnav, who could grab the wind in his fist, in his fist. Mitzara mayim batsimla, who could tie up the water in his garment. Mi'ekim kolav seyaretz, who could understand all the ends of the earth. Okay? In those days they had physics that there were four different basic things, and the four basic materials of the physical world, and shemayim is fire. By heaven, he means the fire. Ruach, of course, is wind. And mayim is water. And afsayaretz is the earth. Those were the four basic things. But they didn't have, Demiri goes into a lot of information that they did not have about that. Today, his questions, we have answers with new theories, but we have other questions that we don't have a clear idea of simply the laws of nature. We don't have all the laws of nature. So he says, if somebody, he kept asking, who is this? And then he says, Ma Shema, what's his name? Ma Shem Beno, what's the name of his son? Kisei Da, that I would know him, that he knows it. You know what I mean? That such a person knows it. Let me meet such a person. And by his son, it means, can he pass it on to his child? I mean, this would, even if there is a person like that, he would be extremely unique. It doesn't mean that there isn't a person like that. It even means that there is not a person like that. Or it means that that type of person that has that type of perfection, that has all this knowledge, it would be a unique person. But it seems to be like it's impossible, because even today, with all our knowledge of science, we still don't have all the answers of how the physical world works. What does it mean by who goes up? In other words, who could go into the area of Eish? Or the ideas of maybe now at time we would translate Shemayim as astronomy into that area and come down with all the answers. Okay? So that's what he's saying over here, that in physics, we don't, even in the physical realm, we don't have all the answers. Verse 5, he says, all the words of God is clear. It protects those that trust in him. Okay? So here he comes to prophecy. He says, knowledge of the laws of nature, knowledge of metaphysics is unclear. You cannot get 100% clarity from there. But however, from God, namely prophecy, that's very clear, and if you will be protected if you trust in him. Now, in what way will you be protected? So verse 6 says, Al tosef al devarav. Don't add on his words, and now we're talking about prophecy. Pen yochiach. Maybe somebody will argue b'chol with you, v'nechzavta, and find you false. In other words, he says, if you go totally by logic, like a philosopher, right, then there is certain information you don't have. And somebody might point out a question about how you're learning, and you could lose everything you have, you see. But if you have a prophecy, so then, if you have prophecy, so then that's very clear, okay? So that's basically what he's saying. In other words, the way it is a protection, the way prophecy is a protection, because if you go totally philosophical, which means you totally rely on the on physics, the metaphysics, if you ever have a, if you have somebody shows you a question, you could lose out on all your religious ideas, you lose out on your religion. So he says, so therefore you should rely on prophecy. And of course the question is, if I rely on prophecy, so what do I need physics and the metaphysics for? And also the question is, what does it have to do with the previous psukkah? Okay?
And how far is the person
supposed to be? By Nebuah, it could be that he actually receives prophecy, but I think that by Nebuah he simply means the Torah. The study of Torah is prophecy.
Oh.
In other words, where I study the Torah, and I have Torah, and then I have the knowledge of the truth of the Torah. Okay? So the question is, what do I need physics or metaphysics? I should just study Torah. So the question is what is this whole, all these six psukim telling us? It's telling us that, it's not telling us not to learn physics or metaphysics. What it's saying is there's a certain attitude that you must have. The philosopher comes with the attitude that what he learns from the physical world is true, and he sticks with it. And if somebody should show him he's wrong, so then he will track that idea and go add a new idea. And he'll keep moving for as long as he sees ideas, he'll keep moving. We're saying that's not the attitude of Torah. The attitude of Torah is that you must know without a doubt that God gave the Torah. Okay? And therefore, that becomes the basis. And the purpose of physics and metaphysics is purposes only to help you understand Torah. But it's not going to change any facts and any ideas in Torah. You must accept the basic Torah. Okay? The Meiri gives two areas. He says in laws, in Torah laws, we have rational laws like civil law. Stealing, you shouldn't steal, and you shouldn't kill. So then you have the mitzvos of like Shabbos and kosher, which is not rational. It's just that God told us, and we're obligated to obey. Now what happened? Like for instance, by Shlomo, he gave philosophical reasons for three of the mitzvos, and he lived by the philosophy instead of the Torah. Or Korach, who rebelled, according to Chazal, rebelled against Moshe, rebelled by saying that you could live the philosophy of Torah and you don't have to keep the laws of Torah. So he was, those two were going with their mind and their logic, and they didn't have a basis, and that was the main essence of their view of life. And they lost the attitude of that you can't give up Torah. Torah must come first. And any logic that comes against Torah cannot be accepted. That's the basis. So it's a different attitude in halacha. And also in philosophy, the Meiri says there's two areas of philosophy. One is that you study Torah, and then you could see logical ideas in the physical world to see where it is. Says then there's other areas that you could only get from Torah through prophecy. You can't get it from the physical world at all. Like like the debt coming debts in the future, one of the 13 basic foundations is that that God will bring back the dead, bring it back to life. Now, there's no physical proof for that. There's no way of proving it in the physical world. You have to rely on Torah. So the thing is that in that area also, in the second area where the only way you can get the information from Torah is definitely you should rely on Torah. But he says even in the logical areas, in physics and metaphysics, it cannot go beyond what the Torah is saying. You must have the basic foundation in Torah. And to get this basic foundation, I'd like to add a point. That is this. Some people have the basic foundation as a proof of Har Sinai, and the proof that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, and that is good, but that is secondary information. There is a proof of the God, of the Creator, that God created the world by the order of the physical world and the and complexity and depth of understanding. Now, the same thing in a book that, even though it was written by our sages, but if you study halacha and you see the depth, you see the order, and you see the complexity, and you see the depth, the abstract ideas, you realize that it can't be made by human. It has to be made by God. And it has to be very, very secure in your mind. There can be no doubt in your mind that they, because if you have any doubt in any part of your mind that God gave the Torah, so then of course then what you see logically is going to affect your life, and therefore you can give up the Torah but based on your logic, just following the logic, you see. So therefore there must be a basic foundation of that there is absolutely no question that God gave the Torah. And then all studies of wisdom, the sciences or the or metaphysics, is only there to help you understand and to get a better idea of what the Torah is talking about. And that way you can't lose, because even if you find that the argument is wrong, so you still rely on the Torah. So then you say my understanding of Torah is lacking because I can't explain it. Why the physical world contradicts it, so therefore I must go delve in deeper in the physical world. Well, simply I don't know how it works. But the fact is, the basis of all my knowledge must be Torah, and therefore there can't be any doubt about that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. Oh, so the question is, what does it have to do with the previous four psukim? He's saying that if you totally relied on wisdom, on your mind, and not on Torah, then you will fail, because we have a model of perfection of what a thinker is. Now, I can't tell you the positive definition of that, but I could tell you in the negative way, that he cannot make a mistake. He knows every aspect of physics and metaphysics, and he can defend it, like the last verse says. He says maybe somebody will ask you a question, and you won't be able to answer it. So what would be the perfect model of a person that's guided totally by his thought, that's only a person that has all knowledge of the physical world and metaphysics, and he could answer every question based on his mind? So what King Solomon is saying, that's impossible. And since it's impossible, so in fact there are certain knowledge you could only get through prophecy. You can't get through your mind. So therefore, he says, therefore you must, even though you learn through Chachma, and this book of Mishlei taught you Chachma and trained your mind to be a thinker, but you have to know that if you're going to go further and get involved in the sciences, there is a certain attitude which you must have, and that attitude is the basic premise of everything is prophecy, and then after that everything is only to understand prophecy. That is the only protection when you go off into the world of physics and metaphysics. We're in Judges chapter 7, verse 2. Okay? And it says, now Gideon has his army with him, and they're ready to go to battle. And God says to Gideon, there's too many people with you that I should give you in the hands of Midian. There's too much. Because God wanted to make in other words, God wanted them that they should know that God really helped them, that it came through God. So he says, the first thing he says, he should tell the people, anybody that's frightened, they should return, and they should go home. So 22,000 went, left, and 10,000 remained. Okay? God says to Gideon, no, it's still too much. Go to the water, go down to the water, and I will sift for you there. And what I tell you to do, right? Who should go with you, right? That he should go with you. And whoever I say I will not go with you, that should not go with you, will not go with you. So the nation went down to the water, and then God said to Gideon, anybody that laps with his tongue from the water, like a dog laps, set him aside. And anybody that bows down on his knees to drink, they should also, it doesn't say this, but that's what it means, they should also go. And it was those that lapped with their hands to their mouth, in other words, they didn't prostrate themselves on the floor, and they didn't kneel on their knees, but they squatted down and put their hands in the water and brought the water up to their mouth. Those are the ones that went with Gideon, and there was only 300 men. That's all. Everybody else of the 10,000, in other words, there were 32,000. And Gideon said, anybody has any fear should leave. 22,000 left, 10,000 remained. After this test, only 300 remained. Question is, what was the test? Okay, that's the question. So the question is, what was the test? What is this test that God has given? Why did God choose only the 300 that squatted and brought the water from their mouth to their through their hands to their mouth, but they didn't stick their face in the water? Now, most of the commentaries say, and the Rabag also included, says that that because people who were used to bowing down to idols and prostrating themselves in front of idols, so therefore they did that. But people that tried to avoid bowing down because they didn't want to bow down to idols. So you see that the nation only had 300 people that did not worship idols. And God wanted to perform a miracle only through those people, because since we're talking about God's personal supervision, God's personal supervision is dependent on the people that relate directly to God. So therefore, he only took those that didn't bow down. Okay? That was one commentary. However, the Rabbah gives another explanation, and he says the reason is that he didn't allow the others to go when they prostrate themselves, stick their face in the water to drink, or if they kneeled down, because they were lazy. Okay? Because that's a sign of laziness. Okay? And therefore, God only wanted people that were not lazy. My question is, if there's a thing that's easy to do and there's a thing that's hard to do, there's nothing wrong in doing it the easier way. What's wrong with doing it the easier way? Except if there's some loss. There's some loss, then that's called laziness. You'd rather not exert yourself and take a loss than exert yourself. You ever notice, especially by kids, if something falls off the desk, they're going to squirm and bend over, and even if they're going to fall off their desk, but they won't get out of their desk to pick it up, but they'll bend over, hurt their back, or fall over altogether. See? So there's consequences there. You understand? So that I understand. That's laziness. But over here, I don't understand the laziness. It's easier to stick your face in the water and you can drink more, and in a more comfortable situation than just taking, you know, a couple of sips at a time. I don't see what the loss is in doing it that way, so I don't understand what the laziness is. That is the question. Doug wants to say, really it's a combination of Cal and Doug, that they want to say that that when you're at war, you have to constantly be alert. And if your face is in the water, at that moment, your alertness is practically gone. But however, when you're squatting, you, even though you're bringing the water to your mouth, but you're still in a situation where you could be aware of what's around you, and so therefore, that would be the loss of sticking your face in the water. That's very good. Okay? Right. I'd like to ask a different question. And that is, what is the difference between haughty and dignity? Right. The opposite of haughty is the... What's the opposite of haughty? I would say the opposite of haughty is a bad self-image. Haughty is where I think of myself more than I am. I have a certain view of myself that's beyond reality. I think I could do things which in reality I can't do. A bad self-image is I feel I can't do things that I really could do. And therefore, the bad self-image stops me from filling my potential, and the haughty view just destroys yourself by trying to do things that you can't do, so you're going to be destroyed. So haughty and bad self-image destroy you in different ways, but they do destroy you, okay? Humility means that I accept myself. Now, humility is the opposite of both of them, because humility is I accept the truth about myself. I know my true value. I know my abilities, I know what I can do, I know what I can't do. And I live according to it. That's humility. Okay? But however, there is something else. And that is that a human being must have a certain respect for himself as a human being. He must have that. Well, I'll put it this way. Maybe a person like... the greats in Torah, the forefathers and the prophets, they had humility. Maybe they didn't need dignity. I don't know. But however, a normal human being must have a certain self-respect. You don't have that respect. In other words, like this. If you dress sloppy, it has to affect the way you look at yourself. Okay? I remember one time hearing... that the question is that when God punished Adam and he had to go to work, the punishment was not that he had to work. The punishment was that he had thorns and thistles, things to interrupt the work. But work was a necessary thing, because you know that it says that he was ashamed, which means he had a conscience. Part of the conscience is that I am above the animals. So therefore, if he ate exactly the way the animals ate, then he would have a terrible bad self-image, and he would never be able to get out of it. So therefore, God, to help him with his dignity, that I am a human being, I am different than the animals, you see? So then, so that keeps him, his self-respect and his self-image. A person must have that dignity. The duties of the heart, Bachi Ibn Bakuda, in his book Duties of the Heart, he says that God wanted people to be thinkers. So why couldn't a person have a good mind when he first born? So he should start thinking early. He says, if a person had a mind when he was first born, and he would recognize his weakness and how dirty he is, and that he's totally dependent on others, he would never pull out of that bad self-image. So it was a good thing that the person should not be a thinker, because if they were a thinker too early, then they would have a terrible bad self-image and they couldn't pull out of it. So dignity is a part of the human being. Now, I was thinking about that case that we gave before where the kid squirms and to pick something up over the desk and puts himself in danger simultaneously that he's doing that. Because of his laziness, he gives up his dignity as a human being. Human beings should get up, pick it up, not start squirming and then you go, but it's a certain dignity that is lost, you see. And a human being must have dignity, unless maybe you reach the level of the greats where you have humility and you don't need that, then you might dress correctly because people should respect a wise person. But however, before that, the reason should be only because of dignity. And you must have a certain amount of dignity. And so therefore, the Rabbah says that the reason why they weren't accepted is because they were lazy. And what their laziness is one is what you said before, that it's a certain amount of alertness that they had, and two, I want to say that it's a certain level of dignity that you must have. One of those two possibilities is laziness is violating one of those two necessary things. I don't know which one is right. They're both possibilities, but they both make sense. The question is, going back where we spoke about Adam, the question is work a good thing for the human being or not? In other words, we're saying that was not part of the curse, that was not part of the punishment, but it was a necessary thing based on his change of personality. It became a necessary thing to give him his dignity. So the thing is that first of all, when I say work, in other words, I'm talking about making a living. A person needs a certain amount of money to live. So each person's needs are different. Certain people's needs are very little. Certain people's needs are more. And also, you should protect yourself for the future. You should have retirement, insurance, whatever a human being needs for practicality. So that he should get through the sweat of his brow, through his own work, and he should have that dignity. Okay? That's explaining Adam. Okay? But it's not answering the whole subject the way you questioned it, and you said, is work good or bad? The question is, if you give up work, what are you going to do with your life? You're going to sit and watch TV, you'll lose your dignity and you'll be a depressed person. So for that person, I say, go out to work. You know what I mean? You need that. That's it. Let's say, for instance, you have a hobby, and that hobby will satisfy your dignity. Or let's say you're very interested in the sport, or whatever it is. There's something that interests you, and you can live, and that could satisfy your dignity. Then when you retire, you don't have to work. But if that will not satisfy you, if you feel somehow that something's wrong, like I know somebody that retired, the guy was in sports, he was busy, he was constantly busy, but he was very unhappy. He felt he wasn't doing anything. He felt he wasn't accomplishing anything. He was an unhappy person, you see. So the thing is that you have to know yourself, what will give you that dignity. You have to be very, very careful because if you don't have dignity, then your retirement, I don't care what age you take it at, will not be a happy one. Okay? So therefore, whether you should actually work, that's a different problem. The person needs dignity and he cannot live like the animals. He must do his own work. But however, if he has the money to retire, then it's a question of their personality and how they look at themselves. If they look at themselves, if they lose their dignity if they don't work, and if they have a hobby, they should still go back to work, maybe work less, enough to satisfy their dignity. Because a person can't live without dignity. Without dignity, there's a bad self-image. And you can't enjoy life with a bad self-image. So a person has to know what he can do. The question again is can we explain what dignity is? I don't know if I could define it precisely, but there is a certain image. It's not that he looks at himself above what his abilities are, but he must accept himself as a human being. Accepting yourself as a human being means I'm different than the animals. I have the qualities of an animal. I have emotions, I have instincts, I need to eat, and all the desires of, plus emotions of an animal, but also I am a human being and I must operate as a human different than the animals. And if I operate exactly like the animals, then I will have a bad self-image that will destroy me. Like I said before, the way a bad self-image destroys you is that it doesn't let you live up to your potential. You will never live up to your potential. The question is, what if you don't feel you're lower than the animals, but you feel you're lower than other people? Well, that's true. That's also a bad self-image. In other words, a healthy image of yourself is not in relationship to anything else, but an objective understanding of who and what you are, what your abilities are, what you can do, and what you cannot do. And the question is, does a person, when they have a bad self-image, are they aware that they have a bad self-image? The answer is no. Bad self-image is an unconscious thing that shows up in the way you act in life. Other people might notice it, but usually the person themselves don't recognize it. And they operate on a lower level than what they have the ability to do. You see? So therefore, when you start seeing that, then you know there's a bad self-image. But usually the person does not know. Neither does the person that's haughty recognize that they're evaluating themselves way above their abilities, and they're going to get in trouble in a different way. They're going to do things that they can't do, and they're going to fail. They're going to constantly fail. You see, both are unconscious, but the results show up in the way they act. While humility must be a true evaluation of the self and live by that evaluation. In other words, you might not have to know whether you have a bad self-image or a good self-image, but you have to evaluate your productivity and what you're doing, what you can do and what you could be doing, and whether you should do it or whether you can't do it. All this is a conscious evaluation about making decisions in life. But making decisions in life must be two things. Reality, what does the reality demand of you? And two, what do I have? What are my abilities to do towards that reality? Now, if you do such an evaluation and you can't live within that evaluation, in other words, you keep pushing yourself for more than you could do, or after you do that evaluation, you can't live up to that evaluation, then you have to investigate your bad self-image or your haughtiness. You see? And the first thing is to first evaluate what you can do in reality and try to live according to it. If you find that you did a good evaluation, but you can't live according to it, then you have to investigate the psychological part of you that's stopping you from living in reality. Now, the question is, let's say, for instance, you're offered a job and you don't know if you have the ability to do the job. Okay? I think there are basically two things which you have to investigate. First of all, you have to get very clearly on a day-to-day basis, like Doug said, on what has to be done and whether you have the ability to do it. But the second thing which you have to know is different jobs have different type of pressure. And you have to know if you could tolerate the level of pressure that this job has to offer. In other words, if you're on a lower echelon, then the pressure might not be as great. Now, maybe you have the ability to do the higher level, but you don't have the ability to take the pressure. You see? So then if you don't have the ability to take the pressure, that would also be a reason why you should not take the job. It's not only your capability of doing the job, but it's your capability of living under the pressure that the job has to offer. All right, we'd like to clarify a little bit more the idea of laziness. In America, they have a very narrow view of laziness. Laziness is if you're not going to work in school or get a job, so then you're lazy. In other words, the framework is laziness is doing your job, making money, and being successful in whatever you do. You see? But we don't look at that. Let's say, for instance, you have a certain pleasure. Let's say you're in the mood for a certain type of food, and you would really enjoy it, but you don't feel like cooking. I'm too lazy to cook. So you eat something you don't care for as much, what you're not in the mood for. So you're not going to be really satisfied. You don't satisfy your needs. Why? You understand? That's laziness. You understand? It could even be for pleasure. Certain people are lazy about their pleasure. Like, they feel like getting a latte, but that means they'd have to leave the house, but they're really in the mood for it. Oh, I don't feel like moving. You see? So they give up on a pleasure because of their laziness. We would also call that lazy. In other words, we're broadening up lazy to where you're going to lose. I mean, sometimes laziness is worth it because what you're going to get is not so good and the laziness is better. I'm not saying not. In other words, then it wouldn't be laziness where you make a real evaluation. Let's say there's a 20-minute drive to get a latte, and you say, yeah, so they're 20 minutes there, 10, 15 minutes drinking the latte, and then 20 minutes back. I don't feel like doing that. I'd rather sit home and play tiddlywinks, you know what I mean, or whatever. So the thing is, then you made an evaluation that you'd prefer doing something else instead. Then it wouldn't be laziness. But however, if you're just not going to do it because I don't feel like moving, and it's not because you're tired, see, then you're giving up on a pleasure. So I say, yeah, you can't be lazy by responsibility, but you also can't be lazy about your personal needs. You see, that's what laziness, and one of your personal needs that we said is dignity. Well, for instance, in the case that we're dealing, I mean, where you have to be alert, so you can't do things in such a way that you're going to lose your alertness. So then you can't give in to your needs because you must be alert. So laziness is a very... We're broadening out laziness to a much greater extent than to what in the American way of life, how they define laziness. The question is that in America we have the drive to accomplish. The question is that industrious? Is that an industrious person? Which is the opposite of laziness. The answer is no, because industrious means that there is a reason, intelligent reason, why you should do this. But if a person has no rational reason why he's doing something, in other words, let's take money, okay? There's a certain amount of money that a person needs for his needs, his enjoyments, his leisure time, and for retirement, and for situations of emergency. At a certain point, after that, there is no need for money. And yet people are driven to make money more than that. You know, there's a game where kids have little children about walking on lines on the sidewalk. There's a little line, you know, in the square. So they either can't put the walk on it or they have to walk on it, you know what I mean? Like it's a neurotic type of thing. That is making money beyond what you need. It's absolutely worthless. You're putting your energy into a neurotic act. You see? Unless, of course, like we said before, if he needs it for dignity. So then if he must do it for dignity, then he should do as little as possible than what he needs to satisfy his dignity and then try to do other things. You see? But when a person is driven to make more and more and more, there's no end, that's a neurotic act.